Session number 21297, wheel 2.
It's a nice wheel 2.
We found the gun, which was upside down in the ditch with the tractor. The tractor was wedged. We couldn't shift it. The gun we managed to shift. But I mentioned that while we were doing this, it's extraordinary how the Japanese stuck to what they were proposing to do. These parties were filtering across the road. They weren't interested in us at all, so far as we could see. They never even looked in our direction, which was just as well for us. Anyway, we recovered the gun, though we had to leave the tractor. And eventually we belted up the road, but there wasn't a thing between us and the rear guard. So that was that. We had several engagements on the road north to Prome. What else?
Can you describe the engagements?
No, they were really ordinary affairs. For some reason, the Japanese decided to bomb a particular area. And if we were within range, we shot them down, we hoped. We shot a number of them down. But it's very difficult. We very rarely did we shoot anything down where we could see it on the ground. So there's a lot of speculation about whether the Japanese, whether the aircraft had crashed or managed to get home. But the best episode that we had was a little later at Tan Ding Wei, where one of my guns engaged a Japanese reconnaissance aircraft at maximum range. They were flying at least 8,000 feet. And the gun hit this plane with the first four rounds it fired. And it flamed right across the sky. Very satisfying. There was no doubt about that one being a dead man. And great was our joy when we listened to the BBC bulletin the following day, and they actually referred to this aircraft being shot down at Tan Ding Wei. So somebody did their stuff with the press notices. What then? Not a lot, really. Just we took the rear of the establishment, the rear of the column, and we protected bridges mostly until the main troops had crossed over behind us, crossed behind us and disappeared, and then we would up sticks and go to the next narrow point, danger point. I remember one night, I'd been on the move all day and the night before, and I said to my Jemadar sub, wake me up when the last troops go through, sub. I woke up absolutely full daylight, and here's Japanese infantry about 200 or 300 yards away coming across the paddy. So we limbered up and got moving with more speed than we'd ever shown before, and off we went. And when we finally caught up with the infantry, the rearguard infantry, and we stopped, I said to my Jemadar Sahib, tell me, Sahib, what time did the last infantry go through? Oh, he said, about 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, why the hell, I told you to wake me up. Why didn't you wake me up? He said, how were we to know they were the last infantry? They didn't tell us. So that was something I was glad not to think of. What else? I think the next was really when we'd crossed the Ava Bridge, and we were retreating towards we knew to be the Indian frontier then. It was interesting, there was a rumor that went right through the army, the Boer army, that we were going to retire to China and be flown back out of China by the aircraft which had been flying stores into the Chinese. It was very generally believed. What started the rumour, I can't tell you. I've not seen it mentioned at any time in any accounts of the campaign. What do we do then? Oh yes, Moniwa, M-O-N-Y. Moni, M-O-N-Y-W-A-R. Moniwa, there was a, we were, had a troop protecting Burdiv's headquarters on the riverbank. Two guns on the riverbank. And the Japanese sent a couple of barges up the river, which we were able to destroy with the, with our Bofors. Very satisfying, very satisfying. Then,
at what kind of range was that?
It's a good question. 200 yards, perhaps, as they came, because we were slightly standing back from the riverbank. 200 to 300 yards.
Did they have troops on us?
Oh yes, they were absolutely laden with troops. Then, from there, we started up in the rear guard again. Trying to think, Shuijin was our final battle. Charles McFetridge would have given you a lot of detail there. He was the senior gunner, and organised a very, very good artillery support for the infantry. It was interesting, the infantry, I think particularly the Gurkhas, were wearing blouses on their backs, which is the frontier, the old drill in the frontier, on the northwest frontier. Infantry wore something on their backs so you could see, distinguish them from the tribesmen. And this was to distinguish them from the Japanese. But it was rather interesting to see the northwest frontier being applied to jungle use.
What was your own role at Shuijin?
I was at that stage, I was formed up with all the spare bodies to march them out. And we were asked to march through the hills to the north of the main body so that we would give a warning of any Japanese encroachments from that side. And then we sat on a hillside in India once we'd crossed over. There was no tentage, very little supplies. Irwin, who was the general commanding Eastern Command, regarded us apparently as a lot of second-class people who had been driven out by the Japanese and not made a very good fist of it, and he wasn't going to provide for much for us. Wavell, who was viceroy, came to see us and called on every unit there and thanked us all personally. He did more to improve morale by that than can be imagined, because we were all in a pretty sour mood when there was no reception committee of any sort for us. And then, what was next on the line? We went back to Karachi to reform. Right, and then when we'd reformed and ready for battle again, we crossed India from Karachi to the eastern frontier. It was a train journey of 14 days. Now, at that stage, the things had become very, very unpleasant in India itself. There were armed pickets on every station that we called at. We didn't see any actual violence ourselves, but we'd arrived once or twice at stations where there had been trouble. Then we were, the whole regiment was in North Assam protecting the airfields from which the airlift was going into China. That was quite remarkable. To see the best part of 100 aircraft warming up, ready to take off in the, after dawn. An absolute steady stream. You could see them from miles away. Why the Japanese didn't make more effort to attack them, I can't think. We had the occasional raid on the airfields, but very little damage done. Extraordinary.
Do you remember the names of any of these airfields?
Murrenbari, Chabwa, two that come to mind at once. We were at Chabwa. It was interesting. I was standing again with my Jemadar Saab on one of the airfields, the edge of one of the airfields, when there was an air raid warning. And the American troops, who were all Negroes at this stage, because they were purely supply troops. The Americans had a principle that they wouldn't employ the Negroes in fighting units, except one or two special units. And I never see anything like it. These chaps were regularly running like hares, clearing barbed wire. They were going to get off the airfield one way or another. And when this had died down, I said to my Jemadar Saab, "Well, what do you think of this lot, Saab?" And he looked at me coldly and said, "I understand, Saab, that they are the descendants of slaves," and walked off. They had very little liking for the American Negroes. The interesting thing is, when we went back into Burma, we went down the Eastern Valley with 28 East African Brigade, who naturally enough were Negroes, African Negroes. And our troops got on splendidly with them, but I think that was because most of the East Africans were Muslims. And that took precedence over the color of their skin. It was an extraordinary polyglot lot when you think of it. One thing that I didn't mention very, very early on, I think I said that there were 1,200 officers on the 1,200 cadets on the Highland Chieftain, which we went out in. We were in the refrigerated meat space without refrigeration, so the quarters were not too comfortable. But the reason that we were there was that the expansion of the Indian Army was enormous, and they simply couldn't find enough officers in India. The civilian population was not great, and they were mostly in reserved occupations. And the Indian officers were few and far between. So they needed officers badly, so they shipped the 1,200 of us out. We were a cargo of all arms. So the Indian Army really expanded on young officers from Britain. And one or two Commonwealth people. We had a very nice New Zealander with us. There's an Australian who wasn't popular. That was not because he was an Australian, but because he wasn't a very nice man. So, this went on until we went back into Burma, which was very satisfying. The I wasn't concerned with the battle of Maktila, but we were covering the crossing of the Irrawaddy to before the battle, which was really our main contribution. And thereafter, we went down with the, as the first of all, with 28 East African Brigade, and then with 7 Div. In the other valley, 17 Div, which we had been with, advanced 400 miles on a 20-yard front. They just went smack down the road after Maktila. Maktila was the only time that I've seen Japanese artillery in action. A lot of shelling.
What did you think of the enemy artillery?
Not a lot. They were not they were not well equipped to start off with. The Japanese artillery was pretty indifferent, I thought. Not well handled. They should have done much more damage than they did.
Did your unit take any casualties from them? Maktila?
One or two men were wounded, but not seriously. It was more frightening than factual.
What was your own job at this time with the unit?
Commanding the brigade, commanding the troop, which was attached to a brigade. We did very little firing. The Japanese, by that stage, the Japanese Air Force had been pretty well driven out of the sky. And there was we had so much material we weren't used in a field role at all. There was no need for us. And eventually we got back to the Rangoon area. I had the great satisfaction of going out to Pegu and seeing the remains of the gun that I'd destroyed, 3 years before? Still there by the roadside.
What was the attitude of the Burmese population towards?
Well, very anti-British during the retreat. They realised we were on the losing side. But when we went back into Burma, of course, they very quickly changed sides. But I never felt at ease with the Burmans. The various ethnic groups, the Karens, Kachins, were a different cup of tea. But then they saw some degree of salvation in our presence. I think they were disgracefully let down. They put all their head into fighting for us. The Burma rifles were mostly recruited from the hill people. And we just abandoned them. Aung San changed sides. Odd. There were a number of so-called Japanese Indian forces, captured officers. In fact, I'm sorry to say that we had a King's Commissioned Indian officer in C Troop who was captured at Moulmein and turned JIF, which is extraordinary because his father was a Viceroy's King Commissioned Officer. And he himself had been through the cadet school at Dehradun. And one would have said a very good officer. But he apparently, hearsay perhaps, he confessed, he wrote a letter to Charles McFetridge asking for his help. And disclosed in the letter of all extraordinary things that he'd actually been leading an attack on Charles, one of Charles' gun positions. I think it's surprising that there were so few deserters, if you like, or those who turned their coats. and a large number of them were very brave men who stood up to a great deal of unpleasantness at the hands of the Japanese. We had one extraordinary thing. One of our Maijuans, in fact, who was captured in Burma, a year later turned up on the northwest front, on the northeast front here, and it came into our lines. Not in very good state, but bright enough. And he had escaped from a Japanese prison, well, a Japanese working party, in fact, not prison really, and had got himself across China and up into the hills and then across to our positions. And he was an Indian peasant who spoke Punjabi and nothing else. He hadn't learnt any Japanese. How he did it, he couldn't tell us. He didn't know what to, he just walked steadily in the right direction. And I remember there was Charles McFetridge, my battery commander, said to me, he said, "Toby, I've got a problem here. Your gunner, Mohammed Khan, I don't remember his name, but it's, said, and I has come in, and I've got two directives. One army directive says that recovered prisoners are to be treated with the utmost care and feted. And so the other directive says that recovered prisoners are to be treated with the utmost suspicion and kept incommunicado." Said, "Which do I follow?" So we talked with him. And
what was your advice?
That we should fate him. He wasn't, he answered all our questions as best he could, and there was absolutely no evidence that he'd done anything that he, except what he said he had. He hadn't been captured in battle. But I still think it's one of the most extraordinary odysseys that I've ever heard of. Oh, there was another oddity. When we were in Burma again, 42, one night, Charles McFetridge was with us. An old man appeared, introduced by the Subedar Sergeant, who claimed to be 123. And he had, he said, served in the Indian Army. Would we give him a ride back to India? He'd been in Burma for a very long time. Charles McFetridge, who was a great student of Indian military history, cross-examined him, and he claimed to have been at the siege of Delhi as a sepoy at the siege of Delhi in the Indian Mutiny. And Charles cross-examined him, and he said, "I'm satisfied that he is what he says he is. He remembers not the great figures of the mutiny at Delhi, but the minor people. For example, he knew the name of the commander of a mountain battery." He said, "I don't think he could have known these things unless he'd been there." But he looked up his records later on. He'd been the Subedar Major of a Madrasi battalion that went to Burma in 1888. And his unit had actually captured the Mogok ruby mines. As proof, he produced three of the most enormous rubies I've ever seen, and offered them to us if we'd take him out to India. Well, I had to say no. I said, "If I take you, look at everybody else who isn't in the army. The rule, we have to draw the line somewhere." And he took it well. Said, "Well, if that was that." Well, it must have been best part of a month later, when we were in, we got back to India, we got down to the nearest, to the station, the railhead, and there was a bit of a flutter as the troops got into one of the carriages, and I looked fairly closely, and I decided not to see the good Subhadar Sahib sitting in the middle of an admiring group. So that my troops had taken matters into their own hands. But it's something, you know, here I am, 81, and I've talked with a man who was present at the taking of Delhi.
So coming back to your narrative, you'd got back to Rangoon, I think.
We got back to Rangoon, and then we were pushed out to Pegu. What was happening was there were so many Japanese coming east, still crossing the road, that every night we set a line of our outposts to stop this. It was this is the Japanese mentality. There were at least 2 miles between the posts, so they could have got through between us without any difficulty. But no, they had to attack us on the way. And I reckoned I was in more danger in that 2 or 3 weeks that I was in those positions than I had been most of the campaign. It was extraordinary. We had wire around our little fortifications. And on 3 nights, the Japanese got at least one or two men through the wire before we killed them. The odd thing was, when we were downwind, we knew when they were coming by the smell. It's extraordinary to me, the Japanese, who are martyrs to cleanliness in the normal way, once they can't keep clean, became absolutely foul. And the smell was indescribable. Mind you, of course, a lot of them were wounded and with festering wounds as well. But it was a useful warning for us. Anyway, I'm glad to say at that stage I was my repatriation came up. So I turned my back on all that little lot. Funny, so much of it is still vivid in my mind. There's a chunk of my life which is quite separate. Now, other people have told me the same thing. Well, I don't think I've got much to add to that.
How do you feel now about having served with the Royal Artillery in the Second World War?
It was a matter of pride. I think it's remarkable what we did with so little. I remember Slim addressed the 14th Army when he was appointed. It was very interesting. My division, all the officers of my division were called to a paddy field. It must have been 300 of us, I suppose, that order. And there was a 3-ton lorry at the end at one point, and a burly figure climbed onto the lorry, looked around and said, "Well, gentlemen, when I was a subaltern in the First World War, when we had a new army commander appointed, we used to say to each other, 'Well, I wonder what sort of a bugger we've got this time. Well, gentlemen, here I am, take a damn good look.'" And then he went on to say, "You're a miserable lot of whining scrimshankers. You're going to get damn all from outside India. So you better make use of what you've got." And he was quite right to do it, because the people were feeling sorry for themselves when you've been chased out for the longest retreat in British military history, about 1,200 miles, I think, from one border to the other, by the route we followed.
And you didn't get wounded?
No, that's very fortunate.